You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 19th of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 302 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be talking freedom of expression and how to get marginalised voices heard with author, essayist and president of Pen International, John Ralston Saul.
And we'll be heading to India and the salt flats of Gujarat to learn how to appreciate the slower things in life with filmmaker Farida Pasha.
We'll also be joined by rock royalty, indie icon Thurston Moore, he of Sonic Youth fame, will be here to talk about the places where art and music meet.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli will be here too, with all the stories that matter for the week ahead. We might even fit in some further Sunday listening in as well, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
What a week it's been. London was quite sort of sun-kissed this week, Andrew, wasn't it? It was an unseasonably pleasant April week. No April showers here. People were fully sunbathing. It was like being in proper Europe.
Tops off. No, it was a very, very nice week. And then there's been the Monocle Conference Week in Lisbon. Plus, talking of travel, we've got two travel books which are just about to come out. We've got the guide, not to Lisbon, but the guides to New York and London, which will be hitting newsstands, bookstands, or bookstalls even, the first week of May.
Unforeseen developments. His finger very much on the pulse. It's Daniel Giacopelli.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny.
Oh, that is excellent. Do you like that one, Danny?
That's the first time I've heard that. I'm a fan. I like it.
That's your theme music now.
Very 1950s kind of bebop. Not bebop.
That's you. Well, your name
Blueberry
actually,
Hill.
Your name you claim means Danny Leather Jacket. I feel that catches that era.
It does quite well. A cast member of Grease.
I can imagine your family in Long Island playing that to you as a little baby.
All the double basses out.
Hiding the shotgun under the mattress.
Yeah.
That's exactly my upbringing.
We knew we had it down. Exactly right.
So I suppose you want to know what's going on this week.
Yeah, be that.
You have to tell me first what dock pudding is.
Oh, I don't know.
From Yorkshire.
I can say I've never heard that expression.
It's the World Dock Pudding Championships today in Yorkshire.
And do you know what dock pudding?
A local delicacy made from the leaves of the Polygonum bistora.
Dock leaves.
Mixed with nettles, oatmeal, onions, and
seasoning. Dock leaves. Do you know what a dock leaf is?
I don't know why the Latin kind of term is there.
Do you know what a dock leaf is?
I have no idea what a dock leaf is.
So a dock leaf is like a big leaf that grows.
Like a bay leaf.
Yeah. Well, no, it's huge. It luckily grows very near normally to stinging nettles. Because when you sting yourself, if you get a dock leaf and rub it on your arm, it takes away the sting of the stinger.
Okay.
But you can eat dock leaves as well.
Well, apparently it's a local delicacy in Yorkshire.
I'm not sure, really.
Have you found this on some kind of specialist Long Island English cultural website?
I don't think you'll find it in Tesco.
Maybe not. Let's move on to Italy.
Yeah, quickly before we ask you any more key questions.
If you want to jet over to Torino right now, you could see the Shroud of Turin. It's only the third time this millennium it'll be exhibited there at the cathedral, I assume.
Why do they keep it under wraps for fear of light damage and so forth?
Were you making a joke there? Under wraps. Okay. They have it squirreled away. I think they bring out a replica one too at times so people don't destroy it.
Try and make off with pieces of it.
Yeah, exactly.
But people still don't know whether it's real or not real. They don't think it's a fake anymore, do they? They don't think it's like a recent thing.
It always seems like it goes back and forth between it was a medieval creation and it was not a medieval creation, meaning it was much earlier at the time of Christ. I don't think they actually have settled on which of the two it is. But we'll get angry letters if we continue on this path. But
We're just having an open discussion about it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Interesting. Intriguing.
Tomorrow, it's the Boston Marathon.
He's not very chatty about his picks this week, is he?
Like he shuts
down the conversation.
I have a lot to go through. The Boston Marathon tomorrow, it's the 2 years after the horrific bombing there, the 2 years ago.
One of the great marathon races anywhere in the world.
Indeed. So that's tomorrow. Also, the Pulitzer Prizes are announced tomorrow in New York. I don't know if we're up for any, but Monocle 24 might win one.
I don't know if they're listening to this segment.
It's funny because, you know, the Pulitzer Prize obviously is a big deal. And it kind of has some international currency. People say, oh, I'm a Pulitzer Prize winning author. But oddly, it doesn't really travel very well either.
Well, you talk to a bookseller and they'll tell you the exact amount of increase in sales that'll go up if, like, someone wins the Booker or something like that. I assume it's the same with the Pulitzer Prize. There's, like, a distinct kind of jump in sales and they could predict what it will be.
That's harder maybe if you're in the business of, like, traditional journalism.
Yeah.
Because can you measure exactly, you know, newsstand circulation the same way? It's probably not quite as obvious a metric, is it?
No, I suppose it's not, no.
And Monocle's up for an award, a Webby Award.
We are indeed.
Do you know what that is? It's important.
You're asking me? No, Webbies are huge.
Go on the Webby and look at the Webby page and vote for us.
Yeah, get your votes in right now.
We're also going to celebrate National Jelly Bean Day on the 22nd in the US. Which,
what happens?
It's
there,
not an official holiday, but it's
not an official holiday.
I googled what it is, and it says it's not a national holiday, but it's a fun day, and there's a list of things you can do, like put jelly beans in drinks or cakes.
Sorry,
Ronald Reagan was a famous jelly bean lover.
What, like, that's permissible on this day only. Surely one could do that any time if you wanted. No,
we should get a jelly bean jar here at Midori House. You ever have that? Like,
what kind of drinks do you put them in?
Like cocktails.
Cocktails. Oh.
I guess.
That's probably quite a novel idea. I don't know.
The Apple Watch is officially launched on the 24th.
I thought this was another type of food we were going to talk about.
no transition there. That's just straight into it. Yeah, the 24th is when you could buy it. Although it's unclear whether or not you can actually buy it in an Apple store on the 24th. It's a bit opaque.
They're trying
to
get you to go to their pop-up stores and things.
You can only buy it online at the moment, I think. You could try it on in person. You could set an appointment time to try it on. But the 24th is when it officially launches.
Setting an appointment time to try it? Is that faintly ridiculous? Or is that...
Well, when you have many millions of people wanting the same product, I mean, it's not like going into your local...
He's lost interest in that as well. He's useless today. The only thing that jelly beans, well, maybe you can have them in a drink, I don't know.
But all went downhill
pudding.
From the...
I don't know what that is.
Okay, we'll end on a slightly sad note. The 100th anniversary of the Gallipoli campaign is on the 25th in Turkey.
You can't end on the saddest, most tragic, complicated story of the whole lot. You can't go from jelly beans to Gallipoli. That's no way to run your news campaign.
Well, there we are. Tom, do you have anything to say about Gallipoli?
No.
Silence. Do you know what happened in Gallipoli?
I am aware of the broad historical brushstrokes. An extraordinary chapter of it. In fact, it is interesting because this, obviously, we've had over the last few years, we keep having these extraordinary centenaries. And quite obviously, it will continue for the next, you know, 2-3 years.
I think they'll have one every
100
years.
Extraordinary lesson in BS you just said there, Tom.
No, but I think it's important. It is important to mark these occasions. Indeed. Maybe not in the context of talking about jelly bean cocktails.
No.
That's the only point I'm trying
to get. A bit incongruous,
yeah. You could take that away with you. A little bit.
That's my news look ahead, guys.
Danny, I don't know if you were trying to do yourself out of a job. You almost succeeded, but I'm afraid we're going to have you back.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with Andrew Tuck and me, Tom Edwards. Our first guest today is an award-winning Canadian essayist, a novelist, who's campaigned tirelessly and fearlessly for the preservation of language, writing, and to acknowledge the power of words themselves. As well as having written numerous novels and philosophical works, John Ralston Saul is also president of Pen International, the world's leading association of writers, whose ranks have included Margaret Atwood, Aung San Suu Kyi, Arthur Miller, Harold Pinter, Salman Rushdie, and many more. And it's John's commitment to encouraging recognition for the power of language which brings him to London today.
He's here this week to meet European Parliament President Martin Schulz to discuss, among other topics, how to give a voice to refugees and how to protect free expression in a post-Charlie Hebdo world. But he's found time to stop by Midori House, among all that too. And John, welcome to the show. Now, I know one of the reasons you've been in Europe is because you're looking at the very interesting discussion that's now happening around the freedom of speech and what we can say and shouldn't say following the Charlie Hebdo attacks. Now, for many people, that has been a slightly divisive moment. People are pulled into the ranks of, we have the right to say whatever we like. And on the other side, we see people feeling that the freedom of expression is a rather, you know, a one-way street in which they get targeted. When you're involved with Penn, do you have to fall on the side of, yes, freedom of speech at any cost?
Interestingly enough, I mean, Galsworthy was the first president. He wrote the first draft of our charter, and you just go back to it, and it basically says untrammeled freedom of expression. And a little further on, it says, you know, writers are not supposed to provoke hatred. So this isn't an argument in favor of a committee writing novels and doing cartoons. It's saying that writing may well and should upset people and disturb people, but that's not the same thing as producing hatred. And of course, the other element in all of this is that you can say almost anything which may not even appear controversial to you, or you know it's controversial. And then the question is, how does the other side respond? Is it grabbed by a group of populists who want to deform what a religion meant or what politics mean or what a nation means and be offended? And so you can't say that because you're offending us. So there's a big argument about how thick should your skin be. And what we know is that where democracy succeeds, people have thicker and thicker skins, which doesn't mean you can't go wrong. But, you know, to say I've got a thin skin and I'm offended is a problem.
I guess what's worrying for the likes of us is, you know, that 20 years ago, you would have seen this as something that you were almost hoping to roll out around the world. And I know that you've been really vociferous in the belief that you need to have more outposts of pen around the world. So it's not seen as, you know, people in Canada or the US or Europe is kind of sending their ideas around the world. But this issue of, you know, of what we can say and what we can't say, it's become sectarian. It's become riven by religion and therefore sometimes race. And it is seen as, you know, what you would have thought was a given, that freedom of expression was a good thing. You now have people standing up saying, I don't believe in freedom of expression. I don't think it's a good thing. I think it's a Western construct and things. Do you find it a time when you have to be even more eloquent about the things you believe in?
I think you summarized perfectly what's happening. I mean, Penn it's 150 Penn centers in 110 countries. So, for example, when I was elected 6 years ago, I'm almost finished, I was elected almost entirely by Africa, Asia, North Africa, Latin America. I would say two-thirds of the Penn centers are outside of the West, which, of course, includes Australia, New Zealand, whatever. So that when Penn speaks, we are not speaking from the West at all. And I may not look like I come from Latin America or Africa, but, you know, I've just come from, you know, staring down senior cabinet ministers in Latin America who are busy killing writers. And I'm basically saying we, because I'm speaking for Mexican writers and Honduran writers, and they've asked me to say these things. So the first thing is, when we speak, we actually have a very clear idea of who we're speaking for, and it's not the West, which doesn't mean there aren't people in the West who are confused about what the rules are. This is an increasingly bad period. I would say the last 5 to 10 years, freedom of expression has been on a really downward slope, and that the rise of populism, the return of populism, which is, after all, you know, Mussolini, it's Juan Perón, it's Napoleon. The return of populism is the return of the idea that race matters, that you can divide people by whatever, race, religion, ideological belief, and you can then be allowed to kill people on that basis. So that's a return of something we've seen several times, and we have to stand up to that.
John, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, again, the way that the world is changing you, that maybe it was once easy to define who the writers were and who the journalists were. And, you know, you had a constituency that was, you know, you could recognize them by their press cards or by their
right,
their writerly ways. But we've just seen in recent weeks, two people killed in Bangladesh who were bloggers right, for freedom of expression. They were killed for the things they were saying, but they weren't trained journalists. They weren't, you know, traditional writers. Now, in a time when, you know, in fact, journalism is kind of losing its way a little bit because of, you know, failing papers, etc. And we're seeing the rise of all of these citizen journalists, all of these people, you know, again, banging up against, you know, what is right and wrong to be said. Do you find that the people who you're potentially looking after is kind of almost all of us?
I've led three delegations to Mexico in the last 4 years. And the first meeting in Mexico 4 years ago, I was sitting there in front of the Minister of Justice, and I knew what his opening line would be, and there were about 10 of us in the room and about 40 of them. And he said, well, I mean, we don't understand what you're so worried about. These people aren't writers. They're just journalists. They don't even have press cards. I said, Minister, first of all, Penn stands for all writers, and writers start with, you know, Elena Poniatowska, who's here in London in this month, all the way to a completely unknown volunteer part-time announcer on a television station. And you don't get to decide who the writers are, and you don't get to decide because you've given them a press card. The readers decide and the listeners decide who a writer is. And so we don't actually say writers and journalists. We say writers, which includes journalists and bloggers. Often we're defending more bloggers, more unknown journalists. One of the biggest problems is of the 200 or so writers killed every year, most of them are completely unknown people. Completely unknown.
And where are the worst places for you at the moment? I mean, Mexico,
Honduras is the worst.
Honduras.
Mexico is, I think, second or third in terms of just killing. Brazil is getting worse and worse. It's about a writer a month, you know, for the last 2 years. It's not bad. It's pretty good. I mean, if you're going to kill people, you know, that's pretty appalling. And suddenly, this meeting we just had in Mexico City, the president of Brazilian Pen was there. And suddenly, for the first time, he was saying, listen, we need help. That's 24 writers in 24 months. This is serious.
When you look at Turkey or when you look at Iran, you know that this is coming. This is state-sanctioned imprisonment, for example, of journalists. But when you're looking at what's unfolding in Latin America, in Central America, do you feel the arm of government in there, or is this kind of local, you know, fiefdoms where a local, you know, elected person maybe or a mayor takes revenge?
Yeah. You can't separate it. I went around saying, and day after day, in these three countries we went to, it's an unholy trinity of corruption, violence, and impunity. It starts with the corruption, and the corruption means that you cannot tell what you're dealing with. And so what the governments want you to think is that it's organized crime. You know, it's a diversion tactic. They want to pick your pocket. They drop something over to your right. You look to the right. They pick your pocket on the left. And they say, oh, it's organized crime. It's an excuse for them not being able to handle it. And for you not noticing that the corruption is so endemic in the whole system that you never know from event to event what's happening in the confusion. So you really have to sit down with the governments and say, look, until you can show us that you are charging, trying, and imprisoning a critical mass of senior civil servants, senior politicians, generals, police chiefs, not policemen, police chiefs, we're not going to take you seriously because this is just diversionary tactics. As the French would say, you're hanging the lamplighters. You're not going after the guy who owns the gas company.
John, Andrew sort of alluded to this citizen journalism phenomenon. I just wondered whether more, I don't know, your sort of academic hat on, is that good news for writing everywhere? Do you think that quality suffers, not to in any way sort of belittle the threats that people face, whether they're celebrated writers or otherwise? Is there a problem that maybe people aren't getting edited the way they used to? Is the fact that anyone can distribute their view, is that always a good thing? Should that view be tempered? And is there a place still for, you know, the great editor to help fashion some of these talents and give them a bit more guidance?
Well, I think there's two things. One is right now there's a bill before the European Parliament to weaken copyright. And there are people, a serious number of people in Europe, who believe get rid of copyright and it'll be a great movement for freedom of expression, to which I would say, we've never taken a position until today on copyright, 94 years. I would say, yeah, that's a great idea. Get rid of copyright, bankrupt the writers, the publishers, the editors, the distributors, the journalists, bankrupt everybody, and then force us all to go back to becoming courtiers of the princes, because that's the only way we'll be able to make a living. Sounds like a great move for freedom of expression, right? A lunacy. A complete lunacy. And that is a partial answer to your question. Of course, it has to be organized in a certain way. The more that you move towards what they're calling citizen journalism or citizen writers, the more you need to have a kind of core which is organized. In a sense, what you and we represent is the kind of heart of how freedom of expression works. And then it goes out through these veins and these arteries. But if you rip the heart out, then all the veins and stuff atrophy, the blood is gone, and then the citizen journalism can't work. The other thing is that in some ways, we had maybe a century of middle-class journalism where journalists could actually pretend they belonged to the civilized middle class. They had houses, you know, they had mortgages. They didn't have to get drunk every night, right? You know, we're actually in many ways going back to the pre-middle class days of journalism, in which it's going to be a lot rougher and a lot tougher. And that's what seems to be happening. So we have to figure our way through that. And we have to keep reminding ourselves that the key to being a writer, any kind of journalist, is independence. Independence, independence. I think we have to look at journalism schools and say, stop teaching these people about technology. If they don't come out of these schools with a really, really tough education in ethics, in history and culture, they're not going to be able to stand up to anything. You know, they're going to fall over in 2 seconds the first time they're attacked by their owner or their editor or whatever.
One of the great things you've been talking about is the fact you can't have freedom of expression if you don't have a language. And one of the things you've been interested in pinpointing in your tenure at Penn is the fact that many languages are vanishing, many indigenous languages, and nothing is being done to protect them, to reconnect them to some life support. Why did you think this was an issue that Penn should get involved in?
What are the most fundamental ways in which you can remove someone's freedom of expression? Well, remove their language. Remove their culture. That's a pretty basic removal of freedom of expression. And this is one of the worst eras in history, as far as we know, for the disappearance of languages and the weakening of languages. And the universities aren't helping because we have all these young academics who grab hold of dying languages in order to turn them into a lifetime income. Is they become the anthropologists for the disappeared languages, which is not what we're after. We're after the reaffirming, the strengthening, and the growth of indigenous languages. I'm a Canadian. The Americas, from north to south, are among the worst in the world. We've destroyed a lot of languages. Say Canada, there are about 54, 55 left, and 45 of them are in danger, and there's virtually nothing happening. It's starting to move. I was just with a bunch of Mexicans and we were talking about what are we going to do in Mexico? What are we going to do in Central America? We actually have to get ourselves to the stage where public money is being spent in a serious way in schooling in order to prove these languages matter. And you know, it's a very basic idea, freedom of expression. There's a language, say there are only 100 people speaking it. When you lose it, now you, the three of us, we're not going to speak that language. But when that language is gone, we've lost access to a way of thinking, a way of imagining a place, a world, maybe an ethical approach, maybe a philosophical approach. It's just gone. It's gone. So we have a real obligation to keep this complexity, this variety, this sort of diversity of languages alive. And so where Penn is really starting to work on that, I write about it a lot outside of Penn. I write about it a lot. And I think that, you know, Europe is, of course, the worst of them all because the European nation state was completely built from, what, 16th, 17th century on the destruction of minority cultures in order to create this myth of the single language, single culture, single religion, nation state. I think now with the EU, one of the good things is people are starting to get back to the idea that you can have multiple cultures, you could have multiple imaginations, multiple languages, and that's very valuable.
John Ralston Saul, President of Penn International, thanks very much indeed for coming to see us here on the Monocle Weekly. Now, Andrew, I know you're rather excited because we're going to be hearing from a bona fide music legend later in the programme. Do you want to hear a little of what he does just to get you in the mood?
He's got a ukulele.
I'm not 100% sure, but let's find out. This is Thurston Moore with Benediction.
That was Thurston Moore, and it seems he doesn't have a ukulele, with Benediction. And we'll be talking to filmmaker Farida Pasha after this.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulet and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at McGlory House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Farida Pasha is a filmmaker with her eye on the slow build. She travelled to the desert in the western Indian state of Gujarat to witness 8 months of ritualistic labour by the area's salt harvesters in the Ran of Kutch, said to be the largest salt desert in the world. The result is My Name is Salt, a documentary concerned with stillness, contemplation and hard living, capturing the yearly cycle of productivity that sees all of the area's salt farms washed away during the monsoon season each year, when the farmers then have to start all over again.
The film features no narration and simply lets its subjects, such as farmer Sanabhai and his family, go about their work up against the elements that include floods, sandstorms and more than a little warm weather. Well, Farida joins us now to tell us what attracted her to this story.
What started me was an article in a news magazine on the school in the desert, and it had some stunning photographs of the desert with it, and that got me started. I started making trips to the desert. And I fell in love with the desert, and I started spending time with the families of the salt workers. And one of the families that I just happened to stay with one night is the family that you see in the film. And what touched me was the dedication with which they worked. I mean, the father, the main protagonist, he's such a perfectionist, so demanding of his family and of himself. And all they are trying to do is make the best salt possible. But they make very little money with it. Yet they put their heart and soul into it. And it was something that really moved me a lot. That's when I decided I wanted to make a film about them and about this attitude to work, which is so rare in the world we live in today.
Farida, perhaps I can ask you more about that, because it is quite striking how much this is about that work and what in some respects can seem like a futile task. You mentioned that there's not a great deal of money to be made, and of course there is this cyclical nature of the process by which it means that it must be endlessly repeated year after year in an almost Sisyphean way. Do you think that that narrative will speak to people who maybe wouldn't necessarily watch something that's very measured in style as your film is? Do you think that sort of sense, that sort of story will help it have a wider appeal, perhaps?
I think so. The film has been screened at many festivals in many different parts of the world. And it always amazes me how people living very, very different lives from the family that you see in the film seem to relate to the film. And it crosses cultures. I think people, at least viewers, have told me that they live with the family in the film. They enter their world and understand very deeply how this very common ingredient that we use every day actually comes to life.
Farida, what I found interesting was, you know, that normally if you saw a film like this, there would be some judgment at play, for example, about, you know, children doing very tough labour, children living, you know, in the middle of nowhere, even if there is a little school for them to attend to. But actually, I found your film quite touching and warm and, as I said, non-judgmental about what's going on. Did you have some empathy with the family and feel, actually, this isn't the worst of lives?
No, on the contrary. I mean, when I compare them, the kids especially, to kids I know, kids of friends and, you know, other family members, and in a way, they have a really beautiful childhood, you know. They have so much time to themselves, and it's something amazing. I have never seen the kids fight, even between themselves. They find things to do even by themselves. It's quite amazing, you know. And I remember Lutz, the cinematographer, once remarking that what a childhood to have in a place like this, and that he wished he had a childhood like this. There is nothing to pity at all. On the contrary, I would say.
Well, yeah, I mean, let me ask you a bit more detail, Farida, because, you know, when you are documenting and recording these sorts of lives, as a filmmaker, is that a tricky balance? Because there's always that dynamic that by observing, by being present, you might be, I don't know, changing the environment or shaping an atmosphere at all. Were you aware of that, or was that never an issue? Was it very easy to record very faithfully what you saw and what you witnessed without feeling that your presence there was in any way changing the dynamics that were at play?
Of course, that is always the question when you're making a documentary film. And of course, I mean, even though this family in particular was very open to the idea of making film, it's quite a different thing when you land up there with a camera. But I must say that it took a few days for them to get used to it. But after which they would forget our presence. Also, I must say that there is a certain boundary that I never crossed. For example, if they were in the salt pan working, we never went inside the salt pan with the camera. We were always outside. So I gave them that space. And I think that was very important, to not to be in their face with the camera. And they forgot about us. They saw us doing our work just like they were doing theirs. So at some point, one of them would shout out and say, "Oh, okay, are you done now? Shall we go have lunch?" You know, so it became a very regular part of their lives.
Frida, I wanted to ask you, there's a moment in the film about halfway through where you're observing four of the family members doing this incredible ritualistic dance that they have to do on this drying out mud to squeeze the moisture out, and you just hear their feet doing this tiny dance across the mud flats. It's like watching something you should be seeing at Sadler's Wells. But at that moment you cut to the sky, and flying over their head is an aeroplane, a big flag carrier heading out of India. Is that shot because you feel this is a moment of change for all of India, and certainly for these people, that this world is on the cusp of changing?
I must say that I never thought of that consciously while editing. It just seemed to fit so well with that whole scene of them working. But of course, it was always to make reference to another world outside this little world of this family in this desert, and there is a whole outside world that's going on with their rhythms. It's interesting, once somebody in the audience commented that they found it very moving because they said they are often on flights and they never think of what's going on under them, you know, when they are in mid-air and there's a whole life going on down below.
And Farida, how tough was it for you? You know, when you look at that film, you can see that the heat is scorching on some of those shots, and you were out there in this absolutely dead flat land. Was it a tough task for you as well?
Yeah, it was intensely hot. I don't think we ever got used to it. But I think what was really tough for me in particular was that there was no toilet at all over there, and you had to go out in the open, and it's so flat, there is no place to hide, of course. It was tough conditions, you know, sleeping on the hard desert floor. But, you know, they live like that, and it always felt a little bit bad to complain about it.
Even things like your equipment, though, Frida, I mean, presumably it's very difficult to work and operate, you know, cameras and all of your sort of high-tech equipment in such an unforgiving environment. Were you ever concerned that that was going to actually be a hindrance to the actual filmmaking process?
Well, we had to take solar panels with us to charge our camera batteries and to charge the laptop to download all the footage at the end of the day. Actually, that was the tough part, was to lug all that equipment back and forth between Bombay and the desert, you know. We were just a team of three people. It was me, the cinematographer, and the sound recordist, and we would lug all of this on our backs and take, you know, an overnight train and then take a vehicle. So it was a long journey to the desert each time. And yeah, and so we had to also think of all of this logistics, because we didn't want to leave the solar panels there in case something happened and, you know, next time we go there it's not working and then we can't charge our batteries. So yeah, all of that we had to take into consideration. It was quite an experience.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. That was Farida Pasha, and her film is called My Name is Salt.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Stay tuned. Thurston Moore coming up after this.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
We had a visit to Midori House from a rock music icon earlier this week. Thurston Moore's the musician who, through his 30-plus years with art rock act Sonic Youth, played through the punk years of early 80s New York, influenced a generation of abrasive musical thinkers in the 90s, such as a certain Kurt Cobain, amongst others, and has built an imposing back catalogue of unusual projects, built through a constant appetite for experimentation and collaboration.
His latest is a piece composed in conjunction with the London Sinfonietta Orchestra, visual and sound artist Christian Marclay, and performed at London's White Cube Gallery. The recording was pressed directly to vinyl at the event, and now a small handful of those are available to buy at London's The Vinyl Factory. Thurston spoke to Monocle's Tom Hall earlier about music, art, and how London is now shaping his creative outlook. But first, let's hear a little bit of that composition.
So what are we hearing there, Thurston?
You're hearing some very mellifluous music that I made with the London Sinfonietta. It almost sounded like Frippinino a little bit.
Right.
Which is kind of wonderful if it does sound like that.
Yeah.
I haven't heard this yet. I mean, yeah. I got the records, but I've been so busy. I've been traveling a lot, and I haven't been able to sort of take one out of its sleeve and play it.
You don't have your portable turntable with you.
I generally don't play my own records. I'm always, like, scared to listen to them. But that sounded pretty cool.
Oh, it's beautiful. Like,
yeah. It was a long instrumental piece, and we could only play for 20 minutes because they were cutting the record while you're playing. It can only fit... You know, one side of a record at 33 and a third, you can sort of hit 18 minutes and the grooves start getting a little too tight and then the needle won't handle it. So the idea was to stop after like 18, 19 minutes. Otherwise, it's going to have to go to the other side of the record and then you're going to miss some music because they'd have to bank another lathe. It was a great sort of parameter to work in, you know, knowing that somebody was cutting a record.
It looks almost like a sort of little factory setup. Yeah. It's like... Santa's little helpers making the music, and then there's a guy at the end making the toy that everyone can go out and buy, maybe.
It was so cool. It was the kind of thing I'm sort of thinking about doing more with my band here in London, because I have this band We did one record last year called The Best Day, but yeah. It's myself and Steve Shelley from Sonic Youth. And
Debbie Googe is in there.
And then Deb Googe from My Bloody Valentine's been playing bass, and this guitarist, James Sedwards, also from Stoke Newington. Deb was there at the performance, and I talked to her about it later. I said, would you be into like doing this? And she's like, I'll do it. She's so open to like doing anything that has some kind of experimental edge to it. Christian Marclay's show, it has a lot to do with Christian's fascination with sound and music in relation to visual art and physical art. And what he did, he had a lathe cutting machine there with a technician and a completely portable mobile vinyl cutting manufacturer there. It was really great because most of the places where I've made records, usually you drive out to these factories where they're making it, and they're just like these oily, dirty, kind of like toxic places. And this was really clean and very professional and very sort of fetishistic in a way.
It's interesting you mentioned like sort of a fetish there because yeah. I'm kind of interested in this sort of, in quote marks, vinyl resurgence because people are sort of saying that there's a lot more being sold, but when you kind of compare it to just the way that people consume music, it's actually still quite a very small amount. I mean, do you think that people are just far more attracted to objects that they can hold?
Well, they are objects, and they're very artful objects, and there's quite a consideration to the making of it because it's a physical vibratory object. And for me, that's, you know, at one point, that's all we had were records. And I think as soon as things went into the digital realm, I think there's a bit of a passion that kind of disappeared. You know, I don't think records will ever sort of attain the stronghold in the marketplace that they ever had because they do not have the convenience of digital media. But the most important thing for me for music and art is like something that I first see and then I touch and then I smell, you know, like listening to a record, I always say is sort of kind of like the last thing I'm kind of interested in because I sort of know what that's going to sound like, you know. And
yeah.
All the other senses become involved and it becomes much more of a relationship that you don't have with digital music at all. And digital music is just numerical information anyway. So your brain sort of hears it once and it processes it once and it doesn't need to process it again because it knows everything it's heard because it's numerical. Whereas I think listening to a record, you hear something new every time because it slightly changes and your brain kind of enjoys that, I think. Gets kind of excited.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people like records. I was reading an interview with, I think, Tracy Thorne.
Okay.
Where she's like, she doesn't care. You know, people ask her, the records or CDs? She's like, I don't care. It's just music. Yeah. I listen to it in any respect. It's just like, I'm not a geek about it.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really curious because I think that's how most people do think, except for myself, because I'm a complete geek.
I think some people think there's a real divide between how punters listen and then they always want to get like a musician's view because obviously the musician is the one that's meant to be getting paid for it.
Yeah.
So I think there's that kind of debate. But I mean, you could go on forever.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to make a little coin from what you're doing. But I mean, if that's the reason you're doing it, then I'm just not interested in, you know, to a fault.
Of course. You have done so much sort of one-off projects and unusual projects apart from, you know, things that everyone will know, like Sonic Youth and things like that. I mean, is there a considerable chunk of that that you just don't even own? Are you still trying to track those down?
There might be a couple of things I don't have. You know, lately I've been sort of going online and eBay and looking for Sonic Youth appearances in magazines from different parts of the world, be it Czechoslovakia or Taiwan or something. Because you would play there and then whatever, a review or whatever, an interview would come out later or something in some very obscure like magazine in these distant lands. But now you can sort of find them sometimes. There they'd be, and they're pennies per pound. But I'm generally more interested in other people's work than my own.
I really like that Dim Stars album you did with like Richard Hell
And
people like that. I mean, I know that's not like super obscure, but like, I remember when I was still buying CDs, you still had to pay quite a lot like on eBay to get hold of one because they seemed quite scarce. Do you ever kind of think of revisiting any of those older bands? I mean, I'm sure.
Well, Dim Stars.
I'm sure people would love to see you and Richard Hell on a stage.
Well, Richard Hell, he's a friend, and he actually came to London last year. He was doing something in Paris, and he wrote to me, said he wanted to come to London and just sort of hang out. And I said, well, that's great. Why don't we do a reading? You know, people would love to see you read from your book or read your poetry or just do a Q&A, and maybe we can set something up at, you know, Rough Trade East or, you know, or somewhere in Stoke Newington, like the town hall. And he's like, no, I don't want to do anything public. I just want to be there and I want to see some old friends and I want to go have a proper English breakfast. So he just sort of stayed in my flat. And then, you know, some friends of mine where I live in in Stoke Newington said, like, you know, I just walked by your place. I could have sworn Richard Hell was sitting on your stoop smoking a cigarette.
The thing I really like about him is he never sort of alluded to being a musician, really. And he kind of seems to have almost just stopped dead after about two or three albums.
Yeah, I mean, he's truly, I mean, that's a poet's mind thinking right there. Yeah, like he's a poet, and he sort of came out of this milieu of young poets and writers who had migrated to New York in the very late 60s into the 70s, and certainly Tom Verlaine and Patti Smith. It was this idea of how you can express yourself in ways that related to what excited you, and what excited people like that was what was going on locally in like rock and roll music. And what happened in like the mid-70s. It was all in the cities. You know, that really sort of changed after a while. They weren't so integral. It became more into these other regions of suburbia. And certainly in the 80s, that became more prevalent. And I really like that a lot. Now it doesn't really matter now because we're in the internet age. It doesn't matter where you live. You could live on Pluto.
Do you think that's a bit of a shame that people aren't forced to come together and kind of rub up against each other, and maybe it kind of prevents like these sort of happy accidents occurring a bit more, because it's kind of like, well, yeah, just email me. I'll choose to read it.
Like, yeah, when you read these biographies of people where they're having these life experiences in the 60s and 70s, I was just reading this biography of Allen Ginsberg, how he meets William Burroughs. It really is just like by turning a certain corner and then running into somebody, you know, who introduces you to somebody else who's in their flat, and then it's all of a sudden. I mean, it's just like those kind of things. But I think those things still do happen.
Well, people do still walk the streets, luckily, so it can possibly occur. I think people associate you and your music and your kind of journey a little bit so strongly with New York. It's like people find it really special when they see you around, because it's nice. Kind of like, there's the New York guy. Like, what? Like people still can't get used to it a little bit.
Well, we always had London guys in New York. Yeah, you know, and that was always cool. I lived in New York since late 76. And I was like 19 years old. And, you know, in the 90s, I split my time between New York and 3 hours north of that in Western Massachusetts, where our daughter was being raised. But I never really had this relocation, like any kind of radical relocation. And so to actually move here to London in my 50s, it was a kind of a big deal, and it still is a big deal. It still feels very strange. And I kind of like the idea of sort of being alien. I really, like, have been falling in love with London. I've come here since the 80s, and I've never really knew too much about it except for, you know, which record stores to go to or what venue you would play at and what was nearby. But to try to figure out the geography of London because of its history is so old, it's become like a real sort of personal research into like how it reveals itself to me. Because a friend of mine who works on Cecil Court in some antiquarian bookstore said, London reveals itself personally and differently to everybody, you know, and it just takes time.
He did a recording about someone in Stoke Newington who did like a bombing campaign in the 70s.
A friend of mine had written these lyrics that I put to music, and it was called Detonation. It was a song in reference to the Stoke Newington Eight, who were somewhat of an adjunct to the Angry Brigade, who were political radicals who, in a way, were protesting and fighting for what they saw as acts of injustice that were going on in civic government in London. So it was a time during Vietnam. It was at a time during quite a few things that were sort of seen as problematic. The Angry Brigade was really interesting in that respect because it was half female, half male. It wasn't typical of that time period where it was just like a male-centric kind of concern. So it was very feminist. And they took it upon themselves to create actions where people weren't getting hurt, but just as gestures to bring attention to like what they wanted to express. You know, it was a time period when these kind of ideas of like bombing these symbols of greed or oppression seemed to make sense. And so the Stoke Newington Eight were brought to trial for some bombings. They bombed like the local bank in Stoke Newington, but in a way it was like flowers in the dustbin, because this bank now is like this really, really great bookstore,
right?
In Stoke Newington Bookshop.
No, but that's cool. It's cool that, like, music can, I mean, because that's something that, I mean, I live in Hackney, and it's just something that I just 100% had not heard of.
You know what I mean? Well, it's a bit of a hidden history. I mean, you know, it has a certain disturbing aspect to it. And, you know, I think when Anarchy in the UK came out with the Sex Pistols and those lyrics, and I think in a way for these people who were really studying in anarchist ideologies, and they must have been so exciting for them, even though those lyrics hardly have the insight of like what their literature was. I think that must have been amazing for them. I like storytelling music, you know, certainly in British folk music, there's this great legacy of storytelling that I find really wonderful. But I don't find that something that I'm too interested in doing. I like writing, you know, and I teach a writing course every summer at this writing workshop in Boulder, Colorado at a school called the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics, which was founded by Allen Ginsberg in 1974 and Anne Waldman. And it's part of a larger university called Naropa. And I think in writing, I find I can go more in that place just, you know, without it being something that's any kind of allegiance to music. And that's, I think, my interest in poetry is because it's a very sort of musical writing.
I believe in Richard Hell's recent book, he was telling a story of, a poetry fanzine he made where someone ate paper and then turned it into excrement, and then they made it into like a papier sort of page in the book, which is one way to do it, I guess.
Yeah,
that's real DIY, I think. Maybe we should leave it
there.
Yeah, maybe. Thurston Moore, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that is just about all we have time for on this 302nd edition, count them, Andrew, edition of the Monocle Weekly. Very interesting to hear from John a little earlier in the programme, particularly so many of these issues that seem very sort of prescient, very trenchant now for people in the sort of journalistic business, looking at, you know, freedom of speech. Of course, there's events like Charlie Hebdo, which John mentioned. But, you know, this is a worldwide problem of, you know, writers who are being denied their voices in many cases. And he impressed me. He talks with such obvious sort of erudition about it.
I think what's strange is, you know, here's a man who sits in front of you and says, this is really the worst of times for journalists, the worst of times for, you know, a drift towards racism and sectarianism. But he kind of confronts you with humour and good anecdotes and interesting stories and an engagement and a passion that seems undimmed by all those hurdles that stand in front of him. And you can imagine if you're a minister and he comes knocking on your door, you kind of listen, not because he's aggressive or tough or brutal, but because he just grabs you by the throat with, you know, not his hands, but with his words. You know, he makes you listen to what he has to say. Just, you know, you always, you know you're going to meet interesting people on the show, but he's one of those people that, you know, I think when he left the room, both of us kind of looked at each other, thought, wow, that was, you know, a great person to meet.
Yeah, inspirational characters. That's what the Monocle Weekly is all about, isn't it? We had Thurston Moore, we had John, we had Frieda earlier. Wonderful stuff. And I think we should thank, as a result of all of that inspiration, the team behind the show. It was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio managers were Claire Urban and Toby Hammond. The Monocle Weekly will be back again at the same time next week, Andrew. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Andrew Tuck. Goodbye.